Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 35 of Zero Ducks Given. And it's a Toby-free episode this week. And I think we're all happy about that. So all of you tune in to hear his wittering, delete this now. But for the 99.98% of you who are still remaining, Finny is here. Finny, you are here, aren't you?
I'm here, yeah. No robberies outside my flat this week, hopefully.
That was extraordinary.
Yeah, I've closed the blinds today, so if it does happen, I can look out covertly without anyone realising that I'm looking at them stealing catalytic converters off the bottom of my neighbour's car. So hopefully that doesn't happen again this week.
Yeah, what did you do? Did you report it to the police? By the way, for those people who are tuning into episode 35, having not heard episode 34 last week, Finny left the podcast briefly because he thought that his downstairs neighbour was being burgled. And it turned out that, in fact, somebody else's car on his street was having their catalytic converter removed by three men with balaclavas and baseball bats.
Yep, spot on. So the safe streets of Northwest London hopefully remain safe for another evening.
Extraordinarily terrifying. Anything happened to you of any import this week?
Let me think. I had a back spasm today, which just confirms to me that I am old, and that wasn't even doing anything either. It was just getting out of bed, had a back spasm. So I'm sure Sussex is going to be happy with that they've signed that for a couple of years.
Have you signed the contract? Have you? It's all done.
It's done and dusted. Yeah,
sweet. Doesn't make sweet. A difference. Nothing to worry about. Lovely.
So yeah. I'm walking around in a back brace at the moment, in a heated back brace.
This is the point at which I'm going to bring in our guest. It is a man that'll be very familiar to cricket fans around the world. A man who has slavishly devoted his life to uncovering really important and interesting information about what's happening at Derby, Worcester, Leicester, whether new floodlights will be going in at a variety of different grounds over the last 10 years, how chief executives are planning for the future in county cricket, as well as uncovering enormous stories of international cricket, and a man who has announced his retirement after 10 years at Crick Info. It is none other than the Pliant's inquiryist himself, George De Bell. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I feel guilty already for people who have been logging on to listen to Toby. It reminds me a little bit of the time you phoned me, I think, at very short notice and asked if I could help you out. And I drove to Wormsley. Do you remember? I didn't ask you why.
Oh, God, yes.
And it was the most humiliating night of my life. And there's a lot of contenders for that.
Your night? It was pretty bad of my night, too, as well, actually.
So Finny, it turned out that when I got there was a huge amount of people, hundreds of people, and Norky here had to announce me and he said, there's a bit of a change on the schedule. Instead of Raoul Dravid, we've got George Nivelle. And honestly, you could feel the exhaling of disgust. And people were in such a hurry to leave Genuinely, they were panicking to get out before I said anything.
Let's be clear.
He had to make another announcement, George, to ask people to be calm. It was horrendous.
And let's put this in context. I think it was about 2014, wasn't it? And it wasn't my event. It was a crazy, wonderful woman called Katie Walker.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was one of the most bizarre. It was called Words and Wickets. It was an extraordinary event that took place twice. They'd sold 200 tickets to Indian billionaires. Yeah. And you didn't quite fit the bill. Let's be brutally honest, George. And it's not your fault. It's not my fault. Welcome to the show. Now then, I've got to do the thing that Toby does now very briefly, which is explain what it is that we're going to say on the podcast. And very helpfully, my producer has given me some bullet points. And we are going to discuss these things quite genuinely, seriously. The men's and women's tours of Pakistan have been called off. After the New Zealand tour has been called off, we're going to get everybody's view on that, especially George's, because I know that you've been up all night writing about that. I want to talk about the T20 Blast. We've seen some extraordinarily weird things happen in that game, that day. The first game, I watched the first half and I listened to the rest of it on the radio. Mark Church brilliantly bringing home an incredible Somerset win against Hampshire, against all the odds, only then to have their hearts broken. First of all, I think we need to address the elephant in the room. So there are people who will have no idea about this. And one of them might be George. Who knows? But an enormous beef exists between Stephen Finn and George DeBell, our esteemed guest who's on today. And I need to clear the air. I like to see myself in this particular moment as Jimmy Carter. It's Camp David, right? George DeBell is Moshe Dayan. Like Stephen Finn is Yasser Arafat, and there is problems in the Middle East. And I think it's basically because you two haven't been talking properly for years. So I think where we've got to start with is Finney, what's the beef? And George, what the hell were you playing at? Finney.
You've obviously naturally over-egged the situation because you are Daniel Norcross and you're probably on your 3,000th cigarette of the day as you spark it up again in front of us. Into the microphone. Now, cricketers, we've got long memories and we don't enjoy, or we're very precious, let's say. And I think we've spoken about it before on the pod, but like different eras of English cricket when we weren't allowed to say much in press conferences, and then it moved through into ones where we could be a bit more expressive and a bit more ourselves. But in my early days of playing for England under Andy Flower, we were sort of under strict instructions to be on message and say nothing else. And I remember doing a press conference in Dubai and I'd actually bowled really well. It was like the first time that I'd really felt like I was doing really well in the England team in the one day series. And I did a press conference and George was there and came out of it and I'd delivered all the points that I thought I had. And then I read the article the next day and I think George said something like, one of the most boring English cricketers we've ever had. And it was something that brutal, because I remember it to this day. I was like, Jesus Christ. I know I'm not the most charismatic person in the world, but one of the most boring ever. I was just Googling it there, trying to find George DeBell, Stephen Finn, boring, but I couldn't find it. But I remember it.
Finney,
I've got a memory like that.
Finney, mate, you are not at
what
all.
What are you going to do? You're going to tell me you're spot on?
You're entirely scintillating. You're the most scintillating person on this. You're the most scintillating person I am looking at right now in the bottom left-hand corner of my screen. You're George, what the hell were you thinking of? There's nothing boring about Finney.
I didn't know this. I'm genuinely really surprised to hear that story. And firstly, if I wrote that, that's appallingly rude, and I'm sorry. Genuinely, I mean, someone will find it, won't they? I'd be able to find it, I guess. I'm amazed that I'd have written anything. So
what did you think? So what did you think the beef was about? Because you thought that you knew what the beef was about, or you thought you might have thought you knew what the beef was about.
No.
So hang on a minute. So, look, okay, now suddenly Jimmy Carter is extremely exposed here because in the red corner...
That sounds like a completely reasonable beef to me.
Well, only if I'd written it.
And if I'd written that, I wholeheartedly would apologise. That sounds crass and unnecessarily mean. I agree with you.
Yeah, but if you wrote it, I would apologise. It's the limpest apology I think I've ever heard, George. Mind me saying so.
I don't remember writing it, but everything I have written in this job is still there. You know, it's not like it gets deleted or anything.
And Finney couldn't find it when he went looking for it.
But I don't think George actually used the word boring. It was like it was another way of saying boring. But that was a brief.
Okay, well, listen. I mean, you obviously I do remember it, and I don't at all. So I'm not denying it. So I think all I can do is apologise. Look, sometimes there are some cricketers about whom I probably haven't been very nice. So if I was Joe Denley, I wouldn't like me because I don't.
What do you say about Joe Denley?
Well, I didn't think he was quite up to it. So, and you know, you have to say it as you see it.
What did you say about Sibley?
I was nice about Sibley. I thought he was worth.
So, you were nice about Sibley. You were nasty about Denley. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't say nasty. You know, I mean, certainly to write about someone's character sounds gratuitous and unpleasant, unforgivable. I mean, I kind of agree with him. He's won me round to his point of view. What a prick. Eh? So, you know, I think if that's what I wrote, I could only apologise. I thought he was just sort of unhappy because, you see, I don't think I've ever been particularly critical of his cricket, but I think he might disagree about that as well. But I don't think that's... I'd be reasonably confident I haven't been.
I made a point. We've talked about it a bit. I made a point to try and... Because after a while, I was just like, you damned if you do, you damned if you don't, go around reading stuff that people write about you. So I just decided after a certain age that I didn't need to read it. And also you actually accept the criticism as a player, like regardless, you have to get your head around it, because if you don't, you go around picking fights, like I think a few guys do at the moment, with everyone in the room, because at some stage people are you play a shit shot or you bowl badly. That's just the way it goes. And people are entitled to write that. But I actually had a question, a semi-serious question for you, George. Did you feel a shift when Trevor Bayliss became England coach about being a bit more open with the media? And did that change your perception of players?
I liked Peter, you see, before him. I found he was open. But over time, I suppose, yes. I think I might argue that it was more Danny Rubin's era when he started. That made more of a difference, and that he encouraged people to be a bit more open, which is definitely the way to go.
Just for people who don't know, Danny Rubin being the communications man at the ECB, and he came in and around, what are we talking about, 2015, 16?
At the end of the South Africa tour, which you remember when England won in South Africa, so James Taylor's last tour, that sort of time.
Oh, right, yeah. Yep.
So, but I didn't have a huge issue before that. Some people you get on with and some people you don't. And, you know, when you write for Crick Info, because the audience is quite big, you sort of take it granted that anything you write is going to be read. So generally the rule would be, if you're not happy to be confronted by it, don't say it. Yeah. So generally that's been the case. But obviously you have days, you have bad days. You have days where you express yourself clumsily, just like you might have days where the ball doesn't come out right, I suppose. And, you know, so if that sounds like a pretty horrendous day.
Yeah, but interestingly, I think Freddie raises an interesting point here that I've been in press boxes only for the last sort of 12 years. And the attitude towards the England team that got to number one under Andy Flower was one in the country, as well as slightly in the press box, which was that they were a bit difficult. You couldn't get to talk to them. They were a bit on their own arses. They weren't deemed as likable. Now, people used to then argue, were they not likable because they got to number one? And that was an English trait. Oh, well, if your team gets to number one, the English always sort of react badly against them, try to sort of bring them back down to earth. But then you look at the team that there is now and their openness, and we sort of see people like Chris Wokes, Josh Butler, Joe Root, you know, very comfortable with the media. They may not be the best team in the world, but they appear to be much more likeable. George, is that a fair assessment? And Vinny,
No, I don't think so, but I think that a lot of people would agree with you. I mean, you have to remember that sort of that team that was number one in the world. One, I really liked watching England win because I'd grown up not watching them be great. And so, you know, to go on the Ashes tour where they win three times by an innings, to see them win the World T20 in Barbados, to see them win in India, Jesus. So, one, I cut them a lot of slack for that. And two, there were people there that I got on quite well with. You see, I get on all right with KP. I've done a book with Trotty. He's a good friend.
You do quite a good impersonation of KP, don't you? I mean,
absolutely ridiculous. And I really like Andy and respect Andy as well. So Andy is obviously an intense guy, but I think he's a good guy. And I liked Andy. Look, I always liked Andy. He was very good about phoning up and saying, I think you've written a rubbish piece, you know. But equally, he was quite good about sending a text if you'd written a piece which he liked. So he kind of earned the right. So personally, I found that team fine. Yeah, I'm not that, you know, I'm 49, I've got children and other friends. I'm not that needy about, you know, whether, well, do you know what I mean? So I haven't overthought it, but I thought they were professional and good and pretty decent to deal with, to be honest.
I do, but I want to talk to you about like, about your style of journalism, though, because, you know, we know people in the press box who and I have great admiration and love for them, but not for this particular reason, but who are very energized when England do badly. You just expressed your excitement at watching England win in Australia, watching them win in India, and, you know, being an English journalist and being able to witness these things. But we know people who love getting the hatchet out. It's much, much easier to write the stories when things are going horribly wrong. There's a great pleasure in that. Without naming any names.
Well, no, because I think, I could be accused of that at times. And there have been, there are times when the devil does have the best lines and that there's a certain macabre ease writing about, say, the 2015 World Cup campaign or the 13-14 Ashes tour. You know, it got pretty grim, didn't it? So. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you don't really define yourself by those things, for what it's worth. It's more fun when England are doing well. It feels like an easier, nicer job. And yeah, it's nice to see them win, but you just got to do the job and tell the truth as you see it.
Finny, you're now in the commentary box and doing tremendously well, if I may say so. Are you conscious of the fact that you're playing against these guys, you know them, what it is that you've got to say, or you know, how do you approach it when things go wrong?
Well, I'm fortunate that because I'm a current player, there's no pressure on me to be overly critical, I don't think. And I can also put myself in their shoes as a broadcaster and try and figure out a solution for them to get out of that situation as I would be trying to do if I was them. So I'm lucky and fortunate at the moment that I have that perspective that I can say, okay, this is the problem. If you accept that that's the problem, you can then put a plan in place to do this, which will then bring better results. So I can put a slightly more positive spin on a negative situation just through my circumstances. When I pack up, and if I hopefully remain in the media in some capacity, then that might be slightly more challenging.
But you say challenging, it opens up a whole new opportunities. I mean, you work around people like Michael Vaughan and other people in the TMS box, and you must be aware that it's way more fun basically to go like charging in, and you'll get the opportunity to do that when you retire. I mean, look, Sussex, I'm terribly sorry. I'm not trying to call time on Stephen Pinn's career, but in 2 years' time, you will genuinely be able to just go both barrels. Are you not like...
I signed a three-year contract, mate. Calm down.
Three? Bleeding hell. How old are you going to be then?
What are they doing? 35. I think everyone thinks I'm about 45, though, like Darren Stevens.
Well, it's funny you should mention Darren Stevens because I wanted to segue straight on to that point. So, Vitality Blast, T20 finals day. Steve-O does it again. And more importantly, T20 County Cricket does it again. I want to get you off your long run, George. Were you there? Were you at Edgbaston?
No, I've had, you can probably hear from my voice, a very bad cold. I was, you know what I was doing? I was just going to find that piece from 2012. I reckon I could find it in about 2 minutes. We'll come back to that.
So what if it doesn't exist? Now I'm scared because of George's reaction. I'm like, have I like made up this thing where George thinks I'm really boring for 9 years when actually there was, he never actually did think I was boring.
He might have said something about Watford, you know, and then you took it to heart because you know what you like about bloody Watford.
Well, I'm actually sweating here. Hold on.
He genuinely is. He's now taking his hoodie off.
My back brace
has gone. Well, don't tell the physio at Sussex. Oh. So where were we? So yeah, T20 finals day. I want to talk about this. I missed the second half of it because I was at a wedding. At a wedding of a massive cricket fan who should have known better, as Jim Diamond said, I should have known better. But he didn't. And outrageously, I only got to see the first game, which was extraordinary and bizarre. Somerset winning, George's Somerset, incidentally, winning from an extraordinary position. We had some remarkable moments. We'll come on to those moments specifically later. But just generally, as a spectacle, having witnessed 100 finals day and the 100 itself, T20 finals day still packed out Edgbaston. There were still all the usual popes and bananas and, you know, seagulls and chips and God knows what else charging about. There was still the same febrile atmosphere. And the quality of the cricket, to what I saw, didn't look particularly different. If anything, there were even more amazing moments. George, what's going on? What is going on here?
Cricket's a really good game. It doesn't matter if it's played over 100 balls or 100 overs, 5 days or T20. It's a good game. And I think if we play it on good wickets and put it on TV, maybe so people can watch it, price it sensibly, people will fall in love with it. So I thought, yeah, that the 100 was largely unnecessary. But that's not to say I didn't enjoy watching 100 ball cricket. Yeah, I think if the T20 had been, repackaged a little bit, I'm sure it could have worked absolutely fine. And my worry about the 100, as ever, is that it threatens the 18-county system. Now, lots of people think that would be a good thing. That's reasonable. I don't. So that's all. Yeah, T20 is a terrific format. Lots to like. And I thought, yeah, finals day was pretty thrilling. And it very often is. We see a lot of good cricket. I wasn't surprised by that.
How do you think the ECB reacts? I mean, there are conspiracy theorists out there who assume that the ECB want County T20 to fail.
Well, I do think that. Yeah, I'll give you one example, and you explain it to me. They measure the ticket sales for every other competition. Yeah, when they talked about ticket sales for the 100, they say tickets sold or issued. Did you notice that as the figure?
No, I didn't. Yeah. No. Because I'm not like you or Alison Mitchell. So I don't do that.
You can trust me on this. You can check. When they gave the attendance figures, they say tickets sold or issued, which includes those free ones given away. Doesn't necessarily mean they attended. When they were giving the T20 Blast attendances, they gave attendances, not tickets sold, which means that they got to discount all the rained-off matches. So in, was it 2019? The figure was manipulated, so it was below 1 million. Why would a governing body manipulate a figure to make it lower?
Oh, hang on a minute. We're all going to go silent if we're not careful. And that's dead air is bad. Dead air is bad.
Well, I think people who were listening will know the answer. People will know the answer, won't they? Because they don't want it to have been deemed a huge success. Because then it's easier to justify the 100. And you've got to be careful with any debate about the 100 that you don't want it to become a binary conversation. So I'm going to say again, I quite enjoyed the cricket, quite enjoy all cricket, but I thought it was a huge unnecessary gamble and it will damage the 18-county system. And I think the more that we learn about it, the more we find out that almost everyone who's been positive about it is benefiting from it in one way, whether they're players who have paid to play in it, nothing wrong with that, journalists who have paid to be positive about it, fine. Administrators who get big fat bonuses for administering it. I don't think there was a huge amount of honesty there. And for all the bat packing the ECB gave themselves afterwards, I think all it showed was that if you market our great game and allow people to watch it on free to air, people will fall in love with it because it's cricket. It's brilliant.
So, Finny, as a player who plays in T20, do you feel remotely undermined by the notion that the governing body might be trying to downplay the number of people who are coming to watch it?
No. I think that, yeah, George hits the nail on the head there. We're lucky that we've got a great game that people love and want to fall in love with and will fall in love with if they're exposed to it. And naturally, the 100 did do that for people because it had the benefit of being marketed very well and on free-to-air TV for a few of the games. So I think that that's obviously naturally made a big difference. I do think that the 100, in terms of the women's game, has done a lot for them that would not have been done in an old system. And again, I know that having the women's games on the same days and stuff at the same grounds made a big difference to those. But I think being able to put them together as the franchise tournament for them has helped. And having got to know quite a lot of the girls at the team that I played in Manchester, they said the same thing, that there was just a completely different feel and vibe around it for them. But again, whether with the same investment into a T20 tournament for them that mirrored the men's, would it be as good? You know, it's very hard to say. I enjoyed playing in it. I enjoyed playing in it very much. The crowds, they felt slightly more boisterous than normal T20 crowds. It definitely felt as though they were behind. And I was lucky I played for the Manchester team, so the only one that actually was from and named after the city that it was in. The London one was as well, but Manchester.
Well, no. It's North London. It's London spirit. I mean, you know, they don't speak to me, Finny. They don't speak to me in the South.
Of course they don't. Of course they don't. You're all reprobates down in the South. So, yeah, it's difficult for me to say because I did really enjoy playing in it. And the feel of a franchise tournament here in the UK was really good. Whether it needed to be 100 ball is yet to be seen. But I do also agree with George that with the same investment, I think anyone can fall into love with cricket.
But George, you've been really big on this. You've talked about the economics of it. Is it working? I mean, you've made it really clear that you wrote a piece in The Cricketer where you said it's cost 50 million, they brought in 40 million.
That's true. I would be a bit nervous about just judging it on economics, actually. But I'll answer the question, I will. But, you know, if actually it works in attracting a new audience, which I accept the game needs, then that's okay. Then it's kind of done its job. So I think it would be a mistake to just judge it financially. But they have said that it created a windfall for cricket, and that's simply a lie. So it cost more than 50 million to put on. I mean, it cost quite a lot more than 50 million, but I have actually the ECP's accounts for it, which were leaked, and the figure is more than 50 million. And that doesn't include the setup cost. It doesn't include the bonuses. You know, it doesn't include lots of stuff. What it does include is the 1.3 million given to the counties each year for 5 years, counties and the MCC, for their agreement to allow the competition to take place. Some of the ECB would say that shouldn't be counted in the competition's accounts. So that's where the disagreement comes. They would say that it brought in money. It's simply not true. The ECB had huge reserves, £37 million, going back 5 years or so before the 100 was thought about. And the counties were kept poor to ensure they were kept compliant. Does that make sense? So they were kind of bribed with their own money to get them to go along with this. And then the broadcast and all the other money that came in, you know, sponsorship and stuff, added up to something like 40 million. Yeah, I think it was 30 million from the UK, 33 million rings a bell actually, from UK broadcast. I mean, I can tell you, I've got the stuff. Do you know what? I will. While you're talking, I'll look it up. So it didn't make money, no. And it's not actually budgeted to do so in this sort of cycle. But that's okay. It's not just about money. It's about attracting a new audience. But of course, they're reacting as if you have to be pro the 100 or you're anti a new audience. You know, if you're not pro the 100, you're anti women's cricket. And of course, I would have said for years, as you would have done, we'll just put some bloody T20 on in front of the paywall. That's all it needed. Yes. I mean, you know, I don't come from a cricket loving family, really. My brother liked it a bit, but I just fell in love with cricket because it was on BBC Two every weekend. You know, the Sunday League. That was my gateway drug. And I'm sure that, you know, I know that the world changes and people say that people don't watch TV in the same way, but I'm sure that if you put finals day on, you know, free to air, people would have loved it. And there would have been a generation of new heroes.
We all know who starts culture wars, George, but we're not going to get into politics today. So let's get straight into politics and talk about Pakistan, because you have been writing an article today. Pakistan-New Zealand series was called off when New Zealand left seemingly abruptly on the eve of the first one-day international. It caused a great deal of consternation. A lot of Pakistan fans desperately wanted to see New Zealand there. New Zealand had travelled there, after all. I believe it. Am I right in saying it's Reg Dickerson, who used to be the advisor, the security advisor to the England team?
He still is.
And is with the New Zealand team at the moment. And they received intelligence.
He does them all. So he does the PSL as well. He's very respected, yeah.
Well, I had an extraordinary conversation with him when I went to Bangladesh in 2016 when Owen Morgan and Alex Hales didn't go, in which he explained the security situation. He's a very, very believable, trustworthy, honest kind of guy, Reg.
Well, we went on that tour, didn't we? We were terribly brave.
We did. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, not remotely brave, because we were surrounded by a ring of steel as we drove through empty streets.
I meant more. I remember, because I think I'm right in saying that was your first tour.
It was my first tour, yeah.
And I remember your first meal. I don't know what time of day you arrived, but you had your first breakfast.
It's breakfast.
And I remember on your plate, you had beef buna, something chocolate pancake, and a glass of wine. I thought that was a ballsy breakfast. I remember thinking that. That's the way to start a tour.
When you're in a Radisson surrounded by a ring of steel, and you can eat whatever you want without fear of people attacking you with scimitars, you're obviously going to eat whatever the hell you can from a giant buffet. I got so confident I ate the sushi at breakfast, which apparently is not entirely recommended in inland Bangladesh. But it was delicious, and no harm came to me. So that's my advice to all people traveling to the subcontinent. But let's talk about Pakistan, because that Pakistan would have been so desperate for this tour to take place, and it did happen at the last minute. But the New Zealand team obviously received credible information, but information that they believed to be credible enough for them to feel that they needed to leave. So, George, do you have any news on this?
Yeah, a bit. So the New Zealand team received a threat today, the New Zealand women's team, that their hotel in Leicester was going to be bombed. And they have ignored it. I mean, they've decided that it came from a nutter, which it might well have done. But who knows? Who knows when it's a nutter and who knows when it isn't? But as I understand it, the British High Commission in Pakistan and Reg, this security company, I think it's ESI Risk, it's called, and the Foreign Office have all not changed their advice for the England team, which is basically, with the protocols in place, which are the same protocols that were used by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge when they visited Pakistan, they reckoned it was safe to go. So, you know, with the proviso that everyone should have the right to back out of these tours if they want to, I think it's a missed opportunity, and I think it's really damaging for Pakistan.
So are you saying that the risk that was made clear to the New Zealanders is one that shouldn't apply to England.
Really? That's the information we have.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
So if you look at the England statement, the ECB statement today, it doesn't really talk about security as being the primary issue. It talks about anxiety and pressure and the fear of all the issues around security. Does that make sense? So the idea that it's been in the news, so therefore people will be anxious, and I think that's completely reasonable. Why wouldn't you be? So I'm not minimizing it. I'm just saying that there is a distinction. In the same way that India, they didn't go home because of an outbreak of COVID, they went home because of fear of an outbreak of COVID. Do you get that distinction?
I absolutely get that distinction.
But it's similar here, I think. But I think it's a real missed opportunity. And I think England have to be aware that they have asked the world and their mother to do them a lot of favors in the last 18 months of that. And they've now abandoned tours of South Africa, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and we don't know what's happening with the Ashes. And I think that friends are going to be in short supply next year. So I think that's on one level, there's that sort of worried about yourself issue. On the other level, I just thought that Pakistan's really suffered, hasn't it? and it's a cricket mad country, and they did England a hell of a favour last year, coming in pandemic Britain before there were vaccines. They were promised they could quarantine in the Hyatt in Birmingham. They got the travel lodge in Derby. We haven't been very fair to them. And they were promised a tour that only lasted 4 days. I mean, it's a city break, Norky. It's not a tour.
Yeah.
And we pulled out of it. And I really regret that. But with the proviso that, you know, well, I would have gone. In fact, I am going to go. I'm going to go to Pakistan in the next few weeks. But with the
Does proviso... Does Reg Dickerson know that you're going? And more importantly, do the credible threats to the New Zealand team know that you're going?
Yeah. And I'm a New Zealand.
They do now.
And I'm a New Zealander too, aren't I?
Oh, crikey. Oh,
yeah, so I think a few people will go in the next few weeks. And I think actually, you know, world cricket hasn't been very collegiate in recent times. And I think that's a shame. We talk a great game about everyone needing a strong global game, but actually the richer countries seem as selfish as ever. And I thought that we had a bit of a responsibility there to go to not just repay the faith that Pakistan showed in England last year, but also... you know, kind of reward and encourage and nurture that love of cricket that exists there. You know, as I say, it was a 4-day tour.
But, Finny, I've got to ask you, England, I suppose quite famously, I mean, it was mentioned by Ravi Shastri, wasn't it? Continued the tour of India after the terrorist attacks that took place there when Kevin Peterson was captain, I believe. So, I mean, do you think that there's a bit of a double standard going on here? That England's prepared, well, say England, Australia and India are prepared to go to each other's countries when all sorts of things happen. I mean, you know, 7-7 happened in 2005 on the eve of the Ashes, the most famous Ashes series in living memory. The largest terrorist incident in London to that point had taken place.
Australia played in London 3 days later.
And they, exactly. Is this a little bit about money? Is this a little bit about India, Australia and England?
So I do think it's a shame that the three big countries run world cricket pretty much. I mean, and I'm not as well versed in the politics of it, or actually I haven't delved into it that much, but it's quite obvious from an outsider looking in that India, Australia and England do run world cricket, and the other countries are sort of sometimes left to fend for themselves, which I think is a shame for countries such as Pakistan, the West Indies, who don't have the infrastructure to be able to make it a success. I think from my experiences, there was only ever one tour that was a security threat for me, and that was Bangladesh in 2016. And Reg Dickerson told us it was safe, so we went, and that was it, and you trusted his opinion. So, yeah, and this is the first that I've heard of what George has said there, because I've not read that much about it. So I'm going to sit firmly on the fence here. But if I've been in that position before, I listened to the advice, and at that time it was the security advice of Reg Dickerson to go. So I went and carried the drinks.
You did. And I was at that tour, and as we mentioned before, and I remember ringing him up because I thought I ought to. I was going to go on the tour anyway. So Adam Mountford said, people are available for you to speak to if you're worried about the security situation. So I rang up, and the person who spoke to me said, look, Dan, what it's all about is a bunch of Muppets slashed up some people in a bakery in Dhaka once in July. They even ran out of bullets after they only killed six people with bullets. And after that, they had to smash people with scimitars. These guys are bloody amateurs. And I thought, this sounds great. So rather than being shot in the head, I'm going to be torn to pieces with scimitars by amateurs. Does this make me feel any more comfortable? But actually, it kind of did. Because, and it was a very good point, because the point was that it was a lone and individual terrorist attack that had taken place in Dhaka. And we got very concerned about the security situation and then had a ring of steel around us. I mean, George will testify. We all went out in the same convoy, six or seven buses. All the roads in Chittagong and Dhaka were completely cleared, and they're normally impossible to get through. And we arrived into a virtually empty stadium and watched cricket.
I mean, I've played in Pakistan. I went to for the PSL final 3 years ago, I went to Pakistan and experienced the buses that can only go 25 mile an hour because the glass and the outside of it is so thick, and the helicopters that line the streets, and literally not a car on the road. You can't see a person from your convoy. There's literally nothing. I think a journey that would usually take an hour through the middle of Karachi took us 10 minutes because we just whizzed down the roads. But I mean, what I would say is you would hope, and I do think, like knowing quite a few guys in the England team, that the decision wouldn't be taken lightly, as if it wouldn't be a flippant, right, well, we're just not going. You would hope that, and I'd like to believe that is the case.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, you can.
Have you found it?
Yeah, I have found it.
Is this the article that you allegedly wrote?
I just sent it to all of you.
Could you not just read it out for us? The same.
I can. Passage. I mean,
in your own words, George. In your own words, because it'll be, you'll feel so much better for saying it.
And I don't love it. So there is a stifled groan when Stephen Finn appears to talk to the UK media. I'll admit that's not a great start. It's not that Finn is unfriendly or unpopular. Far from it. More that, well, his press conferences can be a little bland. Bear with me. Bland was the word, I think. That's not to say Finn is bland in everyday life. By all accounts, he is fine, easy-natured company with a sharp wit and ready smile. Doesn't seem so bad. But compared to some of his England colleagues, the likes of Graham Swan of KP, Finn offers the media very little in the way of soundbites. And why should he? Finn's job, and it's a job he is becoming very good at, is to take the new ball for club and country and dismiss opposition batsmen. It goes on.
It's fine. I thought the last sentence there was going to be, and his job is to carry the drinks around the world for the England team.
I mean, that's probably the piece you mean, isn't it?
No, that is almost, yeah, definitely is. Was that on the tour of Dubai in 2012?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we
go. God, Finney, you are really, really precious, aren't you? I mean, he's actually been really nice. He's been really quite nice to you.
Oh, I know.
By all accounts, I mean, all right, okay, so he's not, doesn't know, and he's like pretending that other people are saying it, but by all accounts, you're quite a nice fellow. You know, you're witty, you're charming, you're smart. And he's also pointing out that, although what he could have done is he could have said, and he's also only 23. Ooh. So what are we expecting from him at this age? For Christ's sake.
I can imagine now, if I'd have listened to my press conferences, because sometimes now when I'm in the commentary box with people like you, Dan, and I'm listening to someone talk after the game, and I'm like, just give us something that we can talk about for 10 more minutes here, please. And I'd imagine if you guys were sat in the press box when I was doing it, you'd be like, oh, for God's sake, I've got to completely manufacture something here for 10 minutes or for my article the
and
next
it's
day.
It's terribly unreasonable to expect you to do that. And so it's a rubbish piece I've written there, of course.
Oh, my God.
Your basic point is right, but I hope it's not quite as bad as you remembered.
No, of course not.
It has happened recently, actually. I'd written about Dominic Sibley, and the first half of it was all about kind of how unattractive he was to watch. And the second half was all about how he was just what England needed. He was fantastic. And either he or his agent or someone had only read the first half, where I compared him to an aardvark. And then they fire off the angry email, or text or whatever it was. And it's like, read it. It's a love letter to Dom Sibley, for God's sake. But anyway, so I've got to learn. So anyway, the apologies still stand. I mean, it was a rubbish piece.
Well,
to be honest.
You say that. I think the lesson of today is that cricketers should read the entire article before getting really upset, and then like go through a whole load of life experiences and come out the other side, and then forgive their journalists. And the journalist should also beg for that forgiveness back. And that way we will reach rapprochement. And this is a beautiful moment, I think.
I'll tell you what, cricketers.
Am I agreed?
Yeah. What cricketers should realise, but it's our journalist's job to show it, how much everyone in the press box wants them to succeed. I promise you that is the case. Isn't that right, Norby?
Oh, well, yes, it is extraordinarily. I mean, everybody thinks that what we're after is complete failure because so that we can have an enormous amount of fun. But actually, we can't help being slightly impartial. Because, and part of it is because,
Partial.
We got the opposite of what you said. That's exactly what I meant. That's the BBC training. That's the BBC training, George. You see, you get like taught to say, "I'm going to be impartial,"
right?
But you can't. You can't be. How can you possibly be impartial when they actually sit, Chris Wokes next to you during a T20 finals day, and then he goes out and plays cricket? You can't not want him to succeed.
No,
because he's so
monster.
Lovely. Yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, it'd be like you'd be a kitten drowner.
It's the case with all of them, though, because basically you're watching kids up to some extent. That's not meant to sound patronising, but people who are younger than my kids sometimes, or often now, do something that I wish I could do. You know, there's a lot of reason to be writing with a lot of humility. We've got a lot to be humble about. So maybe we should make that clearer sometimes in our... But, you know, also we're also not writing a fanzine. I don't know. It's a difficult balance.
Isn't it? It's so hard, George. I mean, and that's what makes it challenging and fun.
And also, from the cricketer's perspective, we have to learn that, and this is actually something that now I think if I was to go and play miraculously, start bowling 90 mile an hour again and bowl them somewhere straight and play international cricket again, I think I'd be far more accepting of the fact that everyone has opinions and it's not personal. I think I was very guilty of taking things personally in the first half of my career. And now I'm over that. And you realize it once you've been around people and you work with them, you realize that people do actually want the England team to do really well.
Okay. Can I just finish this part of bringing you both together so that the beef is gone?
Do we have to have a virtual hug now?
No. I'm going to give you the virtual hug, and I'm going to tell you how you do it. George, you said to me two very moving things about Finney when we spoke earlier today on the telephone. You spoke about India in 2012, and you spoke about Ashley Giles. And I'd like you to tell both those stories now to Finney. And I think at the end of it, if both of you aren't crying, it'll be extraordinary.
I think that what you're referring to is, I remember you bowling on the 2012 tour in India. Fuck, you were bowling quick. And I went out into middle practice. You were bowling at the mitt with Jilo and Stuart Meeker. And Stuart's quick, yeah? And oh my God, it seemed so much quicker. It was thumping up and Jilo was taking it. And you had bowled at some under 19 captain in the nets. Does that ring a bell? I can't remember. Were we in Ahmedabad?
Yeah. Do you know who it might have been? It might have been Joe Root.
I think it was an Indian player.
Oh, an Indian player. Sorry. But
does
I think in the same test match, I reckon it would have been the same test match, yeah, as right. I bowled to Root in the nets. Because I vaguely remember that. I vividly remember bowling at Root there.
And it was Jesus. It was real proper fiery stuff. Brilliant. And then I'm afraid I do also remember I'd had a very late night in Sydney and you were at practice on your own in the nets and you had one ball, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, and you didn't look like the same person. And it also looked, Trotty had already gone home on that tour. It looked as if someone needed to say to you, go to the fucking pub. Because that's what, do you know what I mean? Rather than try and force your way through it, try and work harder all the time. And it looked like you had no rhythm at all, and it looked like you were there early and you were trying desperately hard. You know, there's no lack of effort. And I don't think Jilo meant to stitch you up at all. He was meaning to be honest and actually kind of kind. He just maybe was a bit too public with it. What did he say, George? The expression was unselectable, wasn't it? But he didn't mean unselectable like... I don't think he meant it unkindly. I think he meant to be like, you know... He's a low ebb, as pretty much everyone has gone through that phase at some stage in their career, no doubt, including Jilo. And he just meant to take you out the firing line, I think. But anyway, the difference in those sorts of moments was horrendous. And I don't know what the answers are in those situations. Anyway, those are kind of rubbish memories for you.
Finney, how do you respond to those wonderful and rubbish memories?
Well, yeah, I prefer the wonderful one, naturally, because the other one the other one wasn't, or was actually the worst time of my career. But the challenge, and actually it sort of goes hand in hand with, not quite hand in hand, but if you're reading the press and you're high and then you're low and you're high and you're low, you become so turbulent on your path through your career that you're not very adept at being able to deal with the things that are thrown at you. So actually one of the things that came of me going home and that unselectable tag that I got tagged with, and I agree with you, I don't think Gilo meant it in a nasty way. I think it was to be kind, to send me home, to sort myself out. And had I been more brave and admitted how I was feeling and what I was going through, I'd have sent myself home probably 2.5 months earlier than I did. But I didn't want to feel like I was throwing the towel in or giving up. But I think, those moments in my career are things that when I was younger, I didn't deal very well with, because when I was good, I thought I was really good. But when I was bad, I thought I was really, really bad. So the thing that came as a result of me getting through that tricky period was just trying not to read the press and remain as level as I possibly could.
Do you know, I feel that we've achieved something really special tonight. So, am I right?
You make it sound like I've got to tell everybody... private detective to go around to George's house and knock him off or something.
No, it is that bad. I mean, two titans of cricket, and you're going to be sharing many, many press boxes for years and years to come. George, despite leaving Crick Info after 10 years, an incredible stint, will be back. He'll be around. He'll be doing what he does. And you, Finney, you'll be ubiquitous. And I felt that it was important that these two great men should come together. And I feel that I've achieved something tonight that perhaps, will only really come to fruition in the years to come. And for that, I thank you both, as Jimmy Carter would have done. Well done, Moshi. Well done, Yasir. I'd see a bright future for at least 10 or 15 years until it all breaks apart again over some misconceived slight. What was he saying just then? I didn't catch it through his sneeze. Who knows? But it's time for us to wrap up. It's been joyful having you both tonight, as usual. I've got to remind everyone that the live show, right? It says here, and it's in italics, so it's really important. Don't forget, we're doing a live show Saturday the 13th of November. Can you do anything to help us there, George? 5 p.m. at the Odeon Leicester Square. Go to Ticketmaster and search for Zero Ducks Given. I've already had somebody ask us for VIP tickets, and I'm not kidding. Genuinely real.
Who?
Well, Sharon, who would like to meet you, I think. She wants to meet you and Toby. She knows me already, so she can't want to spend extra money on me. But
what am I going to have to do for a VIP ticket then? What does that entail?
So Sharon, I mean, I think talk through the whole Noble thing, the knocking the bail off. She's pretty good. And she's a big football fan. So Watford, she's a QPR fan. Watford QPR, you must have some tales to tell there in the lower reaches of English football.
That's my first day of unemployment, by the way, 13th of November.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, come along.
We'll see you there.
I've still got a big issue at the door.
What do you think? We haven't maybe even asked you about that. On that bombshell, Finney, it's the end for tonight. I don't know how to wrap up. How does Toby wrap up? I can't remember.
I think he just says thanks, George, for his time tonight. Because usually, George, it only takes 45 minutes. It took us about an hour and a half with Norcross running this absolute shit show.
I've spoken to Norky before. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I talk a lot. It's rain breaks, isn't it? And all that. Goodbye. Is that what we do? Goodbye.
Well, good. I feel this has been very helpful. I do. I actually genuinely, I was very tired before we started. It's quite late, isn't it? It's after 11, and I'm quite hungover from yesterday.
Absolutely, and
actually, it's been quite nice because the world feels a slightly less hostile place.
Of course it does, because you made up with Finney. Isn't it lovely?
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful thing.
Thank me later. Goodbye, all. And we look forward to the next week's edition of who knows what's happening next week. But we'll be doing it with
wrap
whoever
it
is.
Wrap it up, for fuck's sake.
I'm trying to wrap it up. Stop recording. Just stop recording.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.